Now we're going to take a look at a developing story. This is on Israel and its economy. The Tel Aviv Stock Exchange CEO has come out and said Israel's economic power is in danger due to an overhaul, in reference to the judicial overhaul. And when it comes to Israel's economic future, well, all fingers are pointing at the following: a ratings downgrade, and it goes on to say, actually, in the plural form, downgrades, falling foreign investment, which is already happening, and a weaker tech sector, and that is also happening. And finally, let's take a look at, I'm going to stick with Israel, something that Israel has done, and in regards to frozen funds. It has gone ahead with the Israeli Minister Smotrich to have made this decision, suspending funds to Arab towns and also outlets. He said that the money will go to, in his mind, terrorists and criminals. Our take: a lack of state funding will leave three times as many Palestinians in poverty, that's for starters, and this actually could backfire and lead to Palestinians to act against Israel. Smotrich's decision has once again been called racist and discriminatory. So you can add that to his report card. That's what we thought was important in terms of some news that we wanted to cover with an economic flavor. Please send us what you think, wherever you are in this world. We would love to hear from you. Contact information is coming up.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for the in-depth section of the program. Now, in this section, our focus is the CFA franc. A lot has been said about this unit of currency that is used in the former colonies of France in West and Central Africa. But the negatives outweigh any positives for these African countries, which is another way that France has been taking advantage of these countries as a whole. So let's get started. The CFA franc was introduced back in the year 1945, and it's a French-backed currency used by former colonies in West Africa. And it is seen as a key pillar of French influence in the former colonies, which encompasses altogether 14 West and Central African nations. Those are how many countries that France actually colonized. Next, now the CFA currency is actually pegged at a fixed rate against the euro. Under an arrangement with France, African members are required to deposit half of their reserves in the French treasury. Can you believe that? This in turn guarantees payments into euros, even if the CFA member states cannot meet import payments. Now, next up, the downside, as if that wasn't enough. There's so many, actually. Well, member countries, first of all, they cannot use their resources in order to obtain credit, the cash resources, like collateral for their credit. In addition, they need French approval for basic monetary policy tools, such as determining interest rates, and also when they want to control their money supply. In essence, this means that they have relinquished the management of their currencies, and through that, their economies by default, which would then place it largely in the hands of the French. Now, in terms of the critics, let's take a look at that next. Critics have directed a lot of criticisms describing the CFA franc as a symbol of colonialism, and they take a look at that as past French meddling, and also, of course, the violation of economic sovereignty of countries. I think the previous points actually prove all of these three points here. Time now to take a look at two strong critics of France. First, Louis Di Maio, Italy's former deputy prime minister. He said this currency is used to finance France's public debt and weakens the economies of those countries from which migrants depart. Pretty harsh statements there leveled against France. Next up, let's go to a lady, also from Italy. This one, her name, Giorgia Meloni, the Italian prime minister. The colonial currency that France prints for 14 African countries to exploit the resources of these nations. That's what these two officials have said. Why such harsh sentiments against France? All right, let me bring back our guests to see what they think about a couple points here. We are going to have Kamlan Messi rejoins us, director of the West Africa Civil Society Organizations that works with ECOWAS. All right, Kamlan Messi, welcome back. Many African countries are victims of colonialism, which has been the topic of our program, but they have woken up, if you agree. Recently, we're seeing these coups, and they have realized the dark reality that they were living in. And they're aligning themselves with countries like China, Russia, and Iran, and the likes. Do you think the era of Western colonial influence has actually reached an end?
Okay. African countries or African citizens are not looking for a new master or whatever. They just want to diversify their partners. And whether, it is France, U.S., Russia, or China, they want to have the choice to choose to have any partners for their own interests. So the interests of African citizens should not be dictated by any other people than Africans themselves. So that is the reality today.
Wow, very well said there. Let me bring back now our other guest, David Otto, who rejoins us, Director of Defense and Security for Geneva Center for Africa Security and Strategic Studies. David Otto, welcome back. When you take a look at the whole issue of colonialism, we can see the negative consequences, which is very well known, actually. But at this point, when you're noticing the coups and you're noticing what has happened in Niger, the quick question comes about is that whether this has reached the end of the road, that people in the countries that were former colonies, which should have ended the colonial characteristics, are now rising up and saying enough is enough. What do you think?
This is a new generation of Africans. They are young. They have more exposure. They can realize that the deals and the contracts that their forefathers had with, former French and former Western colonial masters, does not work for them. They want to have a change. They want to go into partnership that is a win-win. They want to ensure that, their independence and sovereignty is respected. They want to ensure that their mineral resources, even when they are being explored, there is a benefit to this country. So it's a new generation.
It is said that Niger is being pillaged for its natural resources. Some estimates put the French payout at only $1 million per year for its uranium looted from Niger. But Niger is not the only country in the West African region to witness the coup. Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Chad have also witnessed similar developments in recent years. France colonized 20 nations, including present-day Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Benin, Guinea, the Ivory Coast, and Niger, which are all located in West Africa. Many of France's flagship companies have long established roots in these countries. France currently has around 200 companies or subsidiaries in Mali, 45 in Burkina Faso, 30 in Niger, and about 10 in the Central African Republic. Total Energies, for example, has confirmed that it has been operating in Burkina Faso and in Mali through its network of service stations for many years. The African continent represents 30% of production and 30% of investments for Total Energies.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm filling in for Mahdi Abbasian, who is off reporting. The coup in Niger is seen through a different perspective in the West. France and the U.S. in particular are alarmed because their interests are in jeopardy. Now, this is especially apparent after the decision of the ECOWAS, who has threatened to intervene in the country militarily. Now, ECOWAS was viewed as acting on behalf of France and the U.S., who have admitted, by the way, military intervention remains a possibility. The U.S. has one of its largest and most important drone bases in Niger, Air Base 201. It costs $110 million to build and an additional $20 to $30 million per year to maintain. Niger is geostrategically important for the Pentagon's Africa strategy. It's located in the middle of the Sahel, a region with a lot of U.S. and French military activity, especially through drones, where thousands of troops are stationed on a regular basis. Washington uses its drone bases in Niger, in the heart of the Sahel, to project military dominance in North and West Africa in coordination with the forces that U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, has deployed across the continent. As if the threat of military intervention is not bad enough, the people of Niger are now faced also with another destructive ECOWAS decision, probably influenced by France and the U.S. It's called sanctions. People are angry at this decision for the hardships that they are experiencing, especially when it comes to essentials like food. The closure of borders by ECOWAS poses a special threat to landlocked and impoverished Niger. Amid a worsening food crisis, the majority of key imports, including rice, would normally be trucked from neighboring countries.
If ECOWAS really cared about the suffering of the people, it would not impose such sanctions.
This economist says that the countries that are complying with the sanctions will suffer economically, like Benin, and by default, ECOWAS countries themselves.
Benin will be more affected by the closure of its borders than Niger itself. For the first 6 months of 2023, this closure will have an impact of several billion francs.
What is for certain is that countries in this region of Africa have woken up. Take Burkina Faso and Mali. Both had coups and both have ousted French troops from their countries. And they have both announced that if there is military intervention in Niger, they would react militarily as well. That is because they have pushed back against colonialism.
This is for the people, and this is to resume Nigerian autonomy and throw off the yoke of the former colonial powers in the version of France.
And that does it for this Quick Take section. In conclusion, Africa is rising up. The coups are testament to that. Enough of colonial countries like France taking advantage of resource-rich African countries, and enough of the presence of foreign forces on their soil, like the United States in this case. I mean, if African countries were to reap the benefits of their resources, then the migration issue, as an example, might get solved for the most part, and then Africans will reach what they are entitled to. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in. For me, Kovu Tahwehi, and the team here at Economic Divide, is goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Over 100 U.S. political leaders descend from enslavers. It's time for the United States to confront this history and its impacts. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote, a recent Reuters investigation reveals that more than 100 U.S. political leaders descend from slaveholders. This includes five living U.S. presidents, two Supreme Court justices, 11 governors, and 100 legislators across party lines. Amid rising debates on slavery and its legacy, from school curricula to the movement for reparations, Reuters examined how politicians are reckoning with these discussions as they reflect on their own familial ties to slavery. But many refuse to comment on the findings. This examination refutes the notion that slavery is a relic of the distant past that has no bearing on U.S. current society. It serves as a firm reminder of the legacies of slavery in the United States and how it shapes Americans' political landscape. Slavery was an economic and social system that allowed families to reproduce wealth, status, and power in the U.S. It was simultaneously a systematic issue and an individual choice. Slavery underpinned the economies of Europe, West Africa, and North and South America, and it was upheld by individual choices to buy and sell enslaved people. As the descendants of American enslavers, these plus 100 political elite are direct recipients of the wealth and resources created by slavery. Slavery would shape all parts of the U.S. economy, from agriculture, textiles, banks, insurance, and transportation. The 4 million enslaved people alive in the 1860s generated an estimated $3.5 billion, making them the single largest financial asset in the U.S. economy at the time. It is no understatement that the United States is built on the wealth of the slavery. For many African Americans, the link between slavery and their history is obvious and irrefutable. Those who descend from Africans brought to the U.S. through the transatlantic slave trade have no choice but to be aware of this truth. Unfortunately, the right-wing movements to actively erase this vital history are growing across the U.S. The rhetoric that discussing slavery makes white students feel bad is used to justify this erasure. In Florida, for instance, Governor Ron DeSantis has pushed laws that ban discussing the truth about U.S. slavery in schools and has gutted AP African American history courses of their content on slavery and civil rights movements. The history of slavery isn't just African American history. It is United States history, and all students need to learn it. When discussing the legacies of slavery, the goal isn't necessarily to assign blame. There are no historical slaveholders that are alive now, and their descendants aren't responsible for this horrific system. However, that doesn't negate the need to reflect on how this past system in the U.S. continues to shape this country, to the detriment of some and benefit of others. Slavery reinforced systems of racial hierarchy that still exist in the United States today. Black Americans, even those not descendants of American enslaved people, still pay the price of this inequality. White Americans also don't need to directly descend from slaveholders to benefit from the legacy of this inequality either. Slavery is an uncomfortable topic for most Americans. For some Americans, it evokes ancestral pain and dehumanization, but also resilience and survival. For others, it brings up feelings of shame and confusing questions of responsibility. Movements demanding reparations are striking a chord with many Americans, leading to contentious discussions. On the local, state, and federal levels, there have been efforts to research and propose reparation efforts to address racial injustice, particularly for African Americans. These demands have been met with mixed responses, as some efforts are successful and many others are unsuccessful. Uncertainty looms on how to properly address slavery and the legacy of racial injustice in the United States and move forward.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has paid a two-day visit to Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman welcomed Amir Abdollahian to the city of Jeddah. It was the first time a senior Iranian official met with the Saudi Crown Prince. In their meeting, both officials reviewed bilateral ties and explored future opportunities for cooperation between Tehran and Riyadh. They also discussed the latest international and regional developments. Amir Abdollahian reiterated Iran's determination to improve relations with the countries in the region, particularly Saudi Arabia. He said Iran and Saudi Arabia play a leading role in the region and the Muslim world. He underscored the need to boost dialogue as well as development-oriented ties as the path to success in the region. The Saudi Crown Prince, for his part, extended his own and Saudi King's greetings to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and President Ebrahim Raisi. Bin Salman said Saudi Arabia views the partnership with Iran as strategic. He reiterated Riyadh's invitation to the Iranian president to travel to Saudi Arabia. Before meeting Bin Salman, the top Iranian diplomat held talks with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan in the capital Riyadh on Thursday. In a joint press conference, Amir Abdollahian said relations between the two countries are on the right track and progressing. Meanwhile, bin Farhan confirmed that the Saudi embassy in Tehran had resumed operations, which he described as another step in the development of relations between the two countries. The Saudi consulate in the northeastern city of Mashhad restarted its activities as well. At the end of his trip, the top Iranian diplomat said he found the Saudi authorities with a different approach than in the past, adding that the Saudis are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations. In a social media post, the Iranian foreign minister hailed the discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. Amir Abdollahian's visit to Saudi Arabia was significant, as it was the first time the top Iranian diplomat visited the kingdom since the signing of a Chinese brokered deal between Tehran and Riyadh to restore ties in March. Tehran and Riyadh severed ties in 2016 after protests broke out in Iran over Riyadh's execution of senior cleric Nimr al-Nimr. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi has focused on the expansion of ties with neighboring and regional states, a policy which will, among other things, help Tehran benefit from the capacities of other countries. The latest thawing of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, two prominent countries on either sides of the Persian Gulf, is in line with this policy of President Raisi's administration. The re-establishment of diplomatic relations between the two heavyweights has become a source of concern for Israel and the West over the past months, as the restoration of diplomatic relations between Tehran and Riyadh grew more serious. Arab countries have notably shifted their attitudes to Iran, demonstrating a clear interest in deepening their relations with Tehran.
And at the same time, this development has raised concerns among Israel and its Western allies. Furthermore, an additional cause for their apprehension lies in the potential collaboration between Iran and Saudi Arabia in addressing the Palestinian issue, which poses a threat to Israel's political influence and propaganda efforts. Another source of worry pertains to economic and energy matters. Iran holds one of the world's largest reserves of natural gas, while Saudi Arabia is the leading oil producer. Consequently, Tehran and Riyadh could potentially play a joint role in the energy sector in the near future, the outcomes of which remain unclear for Western countries. In the realm of international affairs, embassy activities are considered customary, and having an embassy alone does not necessarily reflect the quality of relations between two nations. However, the Saudi invitation to Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to visit the kingdom demonstrates Riyadh's keenness to enhance relations with Tehran.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
Looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid, things we have seen throughout those 4 months, may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid Support Forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. in 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019. Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. A coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
As you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean like different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the Allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube Port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the polls, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus." Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "down with France" and "down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there. The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Nigeria's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Nigeria's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, An actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Double standard tarnishes the reputations of the international institutions that supposedly uphold international law. By treating the ICC as a tool to achieve its own ends, the U.S. regime is undermining the credibility and independence of the court. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, anyone supposing that the newfound enthusiasm in Washington for the International Criminal Court, ICC, would open the door for justice for Palestinians, ought not to hold their breath. A closer look at U.S. policy shows that the imperialist power only supports justice for victims depending on the identity of the perpetrators of the alleged international crimes, and whether doing so would align with Washington's interest. With Biden effectively recognizing the ICC's territorial jurisdiction in Ukraine, the U.S. regime is removing its stated principal objection to the court investigating war crimes by the Zionist regime in Palestine. But this does not mean that the U.S. regime will change its tune and support efforts to hold the fabricated regime of Israel accountable for war crimes. 1 year earlier, the court launched an investigation into international crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Palestine is a state party to the court, but the Zionist regime is not. The court's jurisdiction extends to nationals of countries which have not joined the Rome Statute, its founding treaty, when a citizen of a non-member country commits international crime in the territory of a member state. Successive administrations in Washington have rejected this principle, as it would leave U.S. personnel liable to prosecution by the court for crimes that took place in the territory of ICC member states, such as Afghanistan, where the court has an open investigation. The U.S. regime has had a rocky relationship with the ICC, which was established in 2002. Washington treated the court as a threat during the Bush administration, which pressured governments around the world to enter into bilateral agreements requiring them not to surrender U.S. nationals to the ICC, as Human Rights Watch recounts. In 2002, the U.S. regime enacted legislation informally known as the Hague Invasion Act that permits the use of military force to free its citizens or citizens of a U.S. allied country held by or on behalf of the court. The Obama administration took a more circumspect stance towards the court, adopting a policy of case-by-case support for ICC investigations and prosecutors, according to Todd Buchwald, a lawyer who has served in various U.S. government positions. Donald Trump resumed the hostile posture of Bush years, with his national security advisor John Bolton effectively declaring war on the ICC during a 2018 speech at the Federalist Society in Washington. In 2019, the Trump administration banned ICC personnel involved in the court's years-long preliminary examination of the situation in Afghanistan, the first time the court probed crimes committed by U.S. forces from traveling to the U.S. In March 2020, an ICC appeals chamber authorized Fatou Bensouda, then chief prosecutor, to open an investigation in Afghanistan, which could include crimes committed by U.S. military and intelligence personnel, as well as other security forces. Month later, the U.S. regime issued an executive order imposing economic sanctions on the court's chief prosecutor and another court official. The Trump administration's punitive measures were also aimed at undermining the ICC's Palestine investigation. And now the administration in Washington has said that it opposes an ICC probe into the killing of Shirin Abu Aqile, a U.S. citizen and Al Jazeera correspondent who was killed by Israeli regime army sniper while covering a raid in the occupied West Bank. Karim Khan, a U.K. national whose term as ICC chief prosecutor began in June 2021, announced later that year that he decided to deprioritize the investigation into American forces and focus instead on Afghanistan's new rulers. Whether the decision was political or pragmatic, or a mix of both, it left the world's sole superpower off of the hook. Shahrzad Akbar, the former chair of Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, told The Intercept that Khan's decision reinforces the perception that these institutions set up in the West and by the West are just instruments for the West's political agenda. Khan's apparent sidelining of the Palestine investigation and Western powers' sudden enthusiasm for the court only galvanized that long-held perception. The U.S. regime championing international justice for people in Ukraine, on the one hand, while pressuring the Palestinian Authority to stop pursuing war crimes trials at the ICC, on the other, puts the double standards into sharp contrast. Since 2015, the U.S. regime has conditioned aid to the Palestinian Authority on the latter not initiating or actively supporting ICC activity that subjects Israeli nationals to an investigation for crimes against Palestinians. The statutory limitation is both heavy-handed and seemingly in contradiction to the interest of the U.S., which is very happy for the Palestinian Authority to serve as a policing arm of the Zionist regime occupation. A government funding bill approved by a Senate committee in July includes a provision that the U.S. regime president shall provide information to the ICC's Ukraine investigation. Whereas U.S. law previously blocked federal appropriations for the ICC, the bill authorizes $6 million to support the court and $5 million for the trust fund for victims of international crimes. The proposed legislation also prohibits that funding from going to the PA if the Palestinians obtain the same standing as member states or full membership as a state in the United Nations or any specialized agency thereof, independent of a bilateral agreement with the Zionist regime. These glaring double standards make it clear that U.S. intentions regarding the ICC are more political than principled. Ahmad Aboulfoul, an international lawyer working with Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group engaged with the ICC's investigation in Palestine, told the Electronic Intifada that the U.S. cannot expect to be taken seriously when its support to international justice and the ICC is evidently selective and motivated by its political agenda. He added, if the U.S. is genuine about international justice and its support of the ICC, it should support it regardless of the nationality of the perpetrator. The U.S. must understand that the ICC is not a tool. The court represents humanity's collective conscience, saying never again to atrocity crimes regardless of the perpetrators and promising justice without fear or favor for all victims of such crimes. The unequal upholding of the international law was recently condemned by several independent UN human rights experts.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Sometimes false claims and coercive demands are made. Do not accept these. The organization must not give in to coercive demands. Stand by your own positions. Do what you need to do, but do not give it to what they ask you to do with coercion, and do not accept it. Sometimes they make claims that are untrue. Do not accept these claims. They say, you did such and such thing at such a time. No, do not give in to their false claims. In particular, a commitment was made last March, and based on the report I saw, this report is actually new. The other party did not fulfill those commitments, but we fulfilled ours. The other party in these commitments is the IAEA. I heard it did not fulfill its commitments. Anyway, be careful.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another important recommendation is that the existing nuclear industry's infrastructure must not be changed. During these years, the managers, officials, and those who are active in this industry have done important work and built important infrastructures. You may want to reach agreements in some areas. That's not a problem. You can have agreements, but the infrastructures must not be changed. They must not be harmed. These are the fruits of other people's endeavors. Well, you shouted God is the greatest too. May God make all of you successful. Of course, we were prepared to visit the exhibition for 25 minutes. I was given such a timeline, but it took twice that time. That is, we looked at the exhibition for an hour and a half, and now we were at your service. May you be successful and assisted by God, God willing. May God grant you prosperity. O Lord, for the sake of Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, bestow your grace, favor, and protection on our dear young people, our good managers, and our valuable active people in this industry. Make all of them honorable and proud in this world and the hereafter. O Lord, make our intentions in what we say and in what we do divine intentions, and accept them from us. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you all.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In 2008, the UN General Assembly proclaimed the 19th of August as World Humanitarian Day. But years on, Palestinians, especially in the blockaded Gaza Strip, continue to suffer because of Israeli human rights violations. Israel systematically pursues policies and practices in blatant violation of international law. Gazans have been denied freedom of movement and the freedom to use their own natural resources. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars have undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive.
Humanitarian Day, it's very important and significant worldwide, but in Gaza there is a special taste for it because there is a continuous of siege since 16 years and continuous of Israeli aggression, military aggression against Palestinian people, and they conducted war crimes and the crimes against humanity.
The Israeli regime prevents sustainable growth in the tiny coastal territory and perpetuates the already high levels of food insecurity, unemployment, and aid dependency.
We are calling on the international community in order to apply the humanitarian principles in Palestine, mainly in Gaza, and first to have protection for the Palestinian civilians who are suffering from unemployment, food insecurity, and poverty due to this blockade.
On World Humanitarian Day, the Gaza Strip continues to descend into poverty and de-development under the watchful eye of the international community.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on all nations to stand by the Palestinian people because they have been suffering for decades under Israeli occupation. World Humanitarian Day must be used to highlight the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Palestinians are left to fend for themselves as the world continues to turn a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of international laws and norms. Palestinians have been suffering under appalling conditions for many years. Observers say the inhumane Israeli practices have essentially deprived Palestinians of their individual and collective rights. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Religious leaders from more than 200 different spiritualities and 80 different countries gathered in Chicago for the Parliament of the World's Religions, the largest interfaith conference in the world. Since 1893, the organization has brought together people of faith who are committed to justice, peace, and spiritual growth. A key conference was Faith Over Fear, Countering Anti-Muslim Discrimination, which aimed to connect, equip, and energize all people of faith for anti-racist mobilizations or in anticipation of a looming Islamophobic incident.
In the United States, which is where our focus is, it is...